Welcome to the Embodiment Conference. My name is. Oh, that is just not going to work at all. Oh, never accept a dare from Mark Walsh. Welcome to the Embodiment Conference. My name is Leslie Kaminoff, and you may know me as the co-author of the international bestseller, Yoga Anatomy. But I'm also the co-founder of yogaanatomy.net. Now, that's a platform we built 11 years ago where we offer online courses and in-depth anatomy modules that support teachers, teacher trainings, and students all over the world. So that's why we are thrilled to be sponsoring all the incredible sessions here on the Yoga Channel, including my own. And if you feel a connection with the way I teach, I have some great news for you. We are extending scholarships to all members of the Embodiment Conference. And you can find that scholarship info and links to yogaanatomy.net in the description for this presentation and in the show notes. In the meantime, enjoy your body, enjoy your breath, and enjoy your conference. And I'll see you online.
Our presenter for this session. He has been a pioneer in the transmission of yoga and yoga therapy for health healing and personal transformation for over 40 years. He's the director and senior teacher of the American Vinyoga Institute. He's written two books titled Yoga for Wellness and Yoga for Transformation, produced four DVDs on Vinyoga and several online workshops, and he has also developed research protocols for two National Institute of Health studies on yoga for chronic back pain and generalized anxiety, as well as a clinical trial on mind-body stress reduction for Aetna Insurance Company. Please welcome Gary Kratzo. Handing it to you now.
Thank you so much, Sharon, and everyone for being here. I'm going to change my view so I'm not looking at myself, the gallery view, just one sec. And Sharon, I don't know if you know, I didn't hear anything from that promotional video. There was no volume, and I don't know if I'm the only one, but I assume that I'm not. So can you guys hear me, the few of you that I can see your faces? Could you give me thumbs up? Okay, perfect. Well, I'm honored to be here, and I'm very grateful for my connection to the Embodiment Conference producers and promoters to have invited me. It gives me an opportunity to fulfill one of my sort of Svadharma assignments from my teacher back in the early 1970s. I will just do a brief introduction of myself and then give you the context, that Svadharma context, in order to sort of as the context for this presentation. So I went out to Madras, which is now called Chennai, back in 1974, after having spent 1 year studying with a woman who was one of the few American, longtime American students of Krishnamacharya, named Mary Louise Skelton. And I met her in 1973. And just under a year later, I went with her and her husband and a group of music students to South India, and I met Krishnamacharya and his son Desikachar. And that initiated a lifelong study. Now it's 2000, so 1974, it seems like, if I'm doing the math right, it's 44, 46 years since my life has been pretty much dedicated to the study of yoga. I consider myself first and foremost a student of yoga, and then maybe secondarily a practitioner, not secondarily, but the next is a practitioner of yoga, so student and practitioner. And then I've been trained as a teacher and a therapist, and I've been engaged in that work really since the early 1980s in professional training of teachers and therapists. And just to sort of connect the dots from what I said in the beginning about Svadharma, Deskachar told me in the 70s that I would be bringing yoga therapy into the context of Western healthcare. And I was a young man at that point. I met them when I was 19, actually, in 74. And I was a student of religion, and they told me that I was too young to study religion and that I should study Western healthcare. And I said, why? And they said, because you'll be bringing yoga therapy. This was in the mid-1970s into the context of Western healthcare, which turned out to be prophetic. At the time, I had no idea why he said that. And then, of course, Later, he told me that I was old enough to go back to my inner work in the inner practice of yoga. And that really part of my mission is to bring yoga to the West and to educate people that yoga is more than asana, even that asana is more than performing postures. But more importantly, that yoga as a science is designed, was designed by the ancients to address the multidimensional nature of the human being and the human system, and that there are multidimensional practices that evolved over the centuries that were designed to help individuals create a more conscious relationship with themselves at a multidimensional level. And then through that relationship and then the understanding of the tools, along with the ability to assess what's really going on for them, understand how the tools function, to be able to adapt the tools and calibrate a practice that addresses each of those dimensions. And of course, that can be done individually. In other words, if I have a, just to give a simple example, if I have a back pain, I can use some adapted asana to fix my back. If I'm having sleep issues, I can maybe adapt the breath in my asana and introduce some simple pranayama to help me sleep better. If I'm having anxiety about what's going on in the world, for example, I can introduce some adapted breathing to influence sympathetic, parasympathetic regulation, and then maybe some meditation or chanting and meditation to help me change my perspective about myself in the face of the current challenge. And so I can do each of those things independently, but the real gift of, and that's the title of this particular presentation, is the ability to create a truly integrated practice. Not like you're doing an asana practice, now it's done, now I'm doing a pranayama practice, which is really not related to the asana practice, and now that's done, and now I'm going to do meditation. And there's no relationship necessarily between the asana, the pranayama, and the meditation. An integrated practice weaves them all together so that it becomes one practice. And so I wanted to talk in detail about that. Because I don't find that it's the case of what's going on in the yoga world. Let me just give a little context of that. When I first returned from my first 6 months in India and I got the what Deskachar called my Mission Impossible, you heard about that American television show, I guess. He had a lot of American students back then. The Mission Impossible of teaching yoga in the West and teaching Westerners that yoga is not just asana. I was living on the island of Maui in Hawaii, where I lived for 30 years. I'm not there anymore. I live in San Francisco Bay Area. But I was living on Maui, and there were strong movements of asana practitioners, and then there was Buddhist meditators, and there was even a whole tantric, quote, tantric, I don't know what to call it. I won't really justify, give it the name tradition, but a tantric movement. In Hawaii. And of course, when I was in India, I was studying, in addition to the sort of yoga and the kind of lineage of Krishnamacharya, that is the Vishishtadvaita Sampradaya of his familial lineage. And their tradition actually was like a kind of a Vaishnavite Tantra tradition. When I was also there, I was at Madras University studying Shaivite Siddhanta, which is a Shaivite Tantra tradition. So I had immersion in Tantra, both Shaivite and Vaishnavite. And then when I moved back to Maui, I was excited about the tantric world there, but it turned out that was more about sex therapy, which as a young man, I realized I probably needed it, but didn't have anything to do with what I had been studying in India in Shaivite and Vaishnavite tantra. And so there was a Tibetan Lama that just arrived on Maui that same year, Lama Tenzin. If you've seen my book, Yoga for Transformation, you'll see his picture. We became personal friends in the front piece. So I studied, I took refuge literally at the Dharma Center. So I was studying Tibetan Buddhist Tantra, which was very much more similar to Vaishnavite and Shaivite Tantra than the sex therapy they were teaching in the Maui Tantra community. And so for me, it was interesting that over the years, I learned yoga as fundamentally a science of mind and about the transformation of mind. And so it was very, let's say amusing or, I mean, just challenging for me when I was younger and looking at how people were doing yoga and meditation as if yoga is asana and exercise and meditation is something separate. And even the Embodiment Conference when we were sort of setting up our lectures, there was like the category of yoga versus the category of meditation. Yoga is fundamentally about the mind and the transformation of the mind. So I want to talk about this multidimensional science, the way I received it. And the context of that conversation will be sort of the multidimensionality of the human system. This teaching, and all of these teachings, by the way, stem from revered texts. The tradition says that the root of these texts are what's called revelation. The Vedic term, or the Sanskrit term, is aparusheya, which means nobody wrote it. There was no human author, but rather that some people who, in the depth of their own inner meditation, in the depth of that stillness, the teachings revealed themselves to them. So the teaching is shruti, that which was heard is revelation. So the principle from the tradition, you can believe it or not, is that the source of this teaching is revelation. It wasn't that some smart people figured it out. It's that they received these teachings. And that notion of revelation exists in world religions, of course. It's no different in the yoga world. And one of the more accessible Vedic texts from Vedic revelation, that is Rig Veda, Yajur Veda, Sama Veda, Atharva Veda, are difficult to penetrate. But the latter part of that revelatory science is called Upanishads. I'm sure most of you have heard about Upanishads. The Upanishadic teachings are part of Vedic revelation, but they're more accessible. There are lots of stories from a teacher to a student. Some of them, and it's a husband to a wife, and there is actually somewhere there's a wife teaching her husband. This, so you know, back then it was more balanced than it is today, although we're trying to move back into that balanced direction. So this lineage that I was initiated in the Vishishta Sampradaya, they're from what's called Krishna Yajurveda. Some of this won't make sense to many of you, but please don't worry about it. I'll make it practical in just a very short moment. One of their source texts was Taittiriya Upanishad. So even at a very young age, I began learning to chant Taittiriya Upanishad with my teacher and then study the meaning of it. And in the Taittiriya Upanishad is a teaching that I'm sure you're all familiar with. It's in that text, it's referred to as the Panchamaya system. And because of a later commentary, what's became popularized in the modern world is the Panchamaya Kosha. So we use that as sort of the context to start to unpack the teaching of the multidimensional nature of the human system. And I'm going to talk briefly about that now, and then I'll go into the practices, and then I'll talk about the integration of them all. So the West is, the groupthink, if I can use that phrase respectfully, the groupthink in the public of yoga, who thinks about yoga, is that it's some kind of form of exercise. Even in the yoga public, kind of the basic assumption is that yoga is about the movement of the body. And that means the gross physical body. So let's talk about the gross physical body. When we think about our physical body, we're thinking largely about our anatomy. And many of the professional training programs for training yoga teachers in the West are largely about asana, and largely a good quality program. The part of the requirement to be educated as a yoga teacher is to understand some fundamental things about our human anatomy. And so what we think about in relation to this discussion of our human anatomy is that we have a skeletal system, which is our spine, primarily that is the what we call the axial skeleton that goes sacrum, lumbar, thoracic, cervical spine. It's a vertical axis called axial skeleton. And then the shoulder girdle, attached arms, you can see that part of me if you can see the screen. And then the pelvic girdle, attached legs, which combine are what we call the appendicular. So it crosses the vertical axis of the spine. And you know what we're doing in asana, Mr. Iyengar made that word rekha famous in the world today, which translates alignment as an important idea that we can, and alignment of course is not just about anatomy. In fact, I was teaching a class on Devata Yoga this morning on Mahalakshmi, and I was talking about aligning our behavior to our values and aligning our values to Dharma so that we deserve that blessing of good fortune that Lakshmi showers on all of us. That's a little bit out of context, but I want to talk about structural alignment, skeletal alignment, aligning the thoracolumbar relationship and aligning the lumbar the lumbo-pelvic relationship. In fact, you heard that I did one of my first National Institutes of Health study was on low back pain. Part of the reason people suffer from low back pain, one of the reasons, is poor pelvic lumbar rhythm, you could call it that. They don't understand how to control well the pelvic lumbar relationship. So what we're looking at asana for as the science is to help us create alignment, but not just the spinal curves, but the shoulder girdle, the axial skeleton in relation to the vertical axis of our spine. And we have maximal alignment, there's less stress in our body. But our anatomy isn't just our skeletal system. Our anatomy includes the joints, where the bones are connected by ligaments, and there's capsules and other kind of tissue there. So we want to make sure that we understand that we don't want to be hypermobile. We want to have good range of motion. We want to be able to identify whether our range of motion is limited because of muscular condition or is it a congenital ligamentous condition. And if we have hypermobility, we shouldn't be too proud. Actually, we should work to stabilize our joints. One of the Krishnamacharya, I didn't have a lot of relationship with him over the years before he passed, but I had some relationship with him, and mostly it was him telling me something in particular. Often in Sanskrit, not always, and like as if I understood it back then. And so one of the things he told me is that the most important goal in sadhana, in practice, is stability. Starting goal is stability. So we'll talk about that later in relation to physiology, but as we think about it in asana, it means, for example, joint stability. Our job in asana isn't to be able to do the full range of every posture, because for many of us, we'll get there not because we've improved the integrity of our structure, but because we've destabilized it further. And there are a lot of injuries in the asana world, particularly ligamentous injuries, where people overstretch and end up spraining ligamentous tissue. So we want to create stability, we want to create alignment in the skeletal system, stability in our joints, and then respecting that stability, cultivate appropriate range of motion, which also has something to do with the muscular condition. So there's work in the asana to align the bones, stabilize the joints, and then with the muscles, strengthen weak muscles, but then also identify muscles that are chronically contracted and learn how to release that chronic contraction to turn a muscle into a more healthy, resilient tissue. That when it's at work, it's strong and hard. When it's relaxed, it's soft. It has healthy resting tone. And then to be able to use the asana to restore symmetry when we have muscular asymmetry. And one piece, and I'll be finished with asana in just a moment, from an anatomical perspective, one piece that's very important and not talked enough about in my hopefully humble opinion in relation to movement is dysfunctional movement patterns. Neuromuscular movement patterns, which already crosses over into our physiology. The way we move has been patterned into our system since we were a child. The way we speak, our accent, the way we walk, the way we hold our body, and unfortunately much more. These are like, let's call them neuromuscular samskaras. And if we go into an asana practice without being critically self-conscious of our movement patterns, guess what? Our movement reinforces those same patterns. So part of what I learned in asana is it's a way of doing neuromuscular re-education. But what is required to do that is to be able to identify our unconscious and often dysfunctional movement patterns in order to be able to effectively transform them. So when we say that asana is a science of cultivating a conscious relationship with your spine via your breath, this is classic Vinaya Yoga teaching. Asana is fundamentally about cultivating a conscious relationship with your spine via your breath. I'll talk about that later. And then through that, the rest of your functional anatomy in order to create more alignment, more stability, appropriate range of motion, more balanced muscular symmetry, releasing chronically contracted muscles, strengthening chronically weak muscles, and then identifying and transforming dysfunctional movement patterns. That's the anatomical piece. And for us, that's done as we become more deeply aware of what's actually going on in our system. And then we use the adapted methodology of breath and movement, which we call asana practice, in order to create change in a positive direction. So that's kind of the thought. You know what the implication of that is? It's not about the asana. Even asana is not about the asana. Here's what my teacher taught me. Your job as a practitioner is not to master the form of the posture. I hope this isn't provocative. Well, maybe it is. He taught that way, by the way. He was a great provoker to challenge my presuppositions. So he said, our job in asana practice is not to master the forms of the posture. Our job in asana practice is to use the asanas as mirrors to help us identify what's going on in our condition, and then as tools to affect transformation. And furthermore, he said that the asana has no value in its own. Its only value is the value it serves you in the moment you're practicing it. So it's a constant process of increasing our self-awareness. So that's dimension one, that's asana. And you know what, I have students who back in the 70s who came to me to help them go further in their Ashtanga series. And I said, okay, we can do that. Students who came to me to help them improve their golf swing or their performance on the tennis court, or, you know, to help them with the back pain. And so we used asana, not as part of an integrated practice, but just as a science of understanding and transforming our structure. But we're not just that. And in fact, I joke when I used to do now defunct yoga journal conferences where I went for 25 years. When I was doing certain keynotes, I used to ask people this kind of, as a sort of provocative, self-reflective question. After all, what's more important for you, your hamstrings or your liver? You know, and most people, of course, the way they answer that was liver, of course. There are some people who in the asana world, by the way, not just the asana world, dance world as well, who know more about their hamstring because they have hamstring attachment injury, a very common injury in the asana world, in the sport world. It's a tendinous injury. And they're not, fortunately for them, not aware of their liver. But even those people in the long run felt that for their long-term well-being, their liver is more important than their hamstring. And it's just sort of a silly way of reflecting that so much of us are obsessed with our anatomy in yoga, not realizing that our physiology is, in fact, much more important. In our lineage, Natha Muni, who was the ancestral origin of what we call Vinaya Yoga, said that for the sunrise stage of life, and I can't see all your faces, but my friends who I can see, guess what? The sun has risen for you guys. Sunrise stage of life, maybe first 30 years, that's a stretch of life. Asana is, of course, a major part of practice. But once you're in midday stage of life, which is where most of us probably are, our physiology is actually more important. And our physiological condition is what will carry us. We need to have good functioning anatomy, but we really want to be able to influence our physiology. And there's a medium, a way in which we do that through our work. So I'm going to just give you one thought about physiology. The physiology is particularly all the systems that are controlled. There's more than that. I'm making this very simple now, that are controlled by the autonomic nervous system. So for example, the digestive system, the respiratory system, the cardiovascular system, the endocrine system, the immune system, the nervous system, and the reproductive system, just to name the main ones. And they're all controlled by a combination of primarily it's the autonomic nervous system, which is sympathetic, parasympathetic regulation. And then there's also the endocrine system, and even the immune system certainly the autonomic nervous system and the endocrine system are primary controlling. Let's not get too technical for this presentation. And most of the pharmaceuticals that are prescribed, by the way, for patients who are suffering from chronic illness, the pharmacology that's prescribed for helping them manage their symptoms of chronic illness are sympathetic, parasympathetic activators. So the ancients knew that. Pranayama, breath, is a sympathetic, parasympathetic activator. So for us, when we want to influence our physiology, our, for lack of a better word, energy, we can do that by the choice of asana, the way in which we control the breath in the asana, and then the art and science of pranayama. So now we're talking about not just our anatomy, but our anatomy and our physiology, not just asana, but breath-centric asana and breath adaptation in asana and pranayama to be able to influence the autonomic nervous system and via the autonomic nervous system, the other parts of our physiology. So as I said a moment ago, we are trying in asana to cultivate a conscious relationship with our spine via our breath, and then through our spine, the rest of our functional anatomy in the ways that I laid out. With breath-centric asana and pranayama, we are trying to create a conscious relationship with our physiology via the breath, and then we're trying to create a conscious relationship with our autonomic nervous system via the breath. And then through the autonomic nervous system, influence the rest of our physiological functioning. So I wanted to say that one more time. Just analogous, conscious relationship to the spine via the breath, and through the spine, the rest of our functional anatomy in asana. Conscious relationship to our autonomic nervous system. And via our autonomic nervous system, the rest of our, through the breath, and then via the autonomic nervous system influencing the rest of our physiology. I hope that's clear. So that's asana and pranayama, that's anatomy and physiology. But, you know, I used to joke, you know, what's more important, your hamstrings or your liver? The next silly question is, well, what's more important? I shouldn't be looking at chat, but it just popped up on my screen. So I will repeat that again, because especially I misspoke. So think of this, yoga is about relationship. The actual Sanskrit root yuj means to join, to connect, to join. We say link or join. So in this context, we're creating a conscious relationship with ourselves at a multidimensional level through all of these tools of practice. Who is us that we're creating? Who's that conscious? That's awareness, that's pure awareness, that's Purusha or Atman. So we can create a conscious relationship with our spine. In asana, we're creating a conscious relationship with our spine. Our consciousness is having a conscious relationship with our spine via the breath. And through the breath, the rest of the autonomic, the rest of the functional anatomy. In pranayama, we're creating a conscious relationship with our autonomic nervous system, again, via the breath, and through the autonomic nervous system, gaining an ability to influence the functioning of our physiology. So there, I tried to say it again. And then, so the next step is and the joke I used to ask, so, okay, what's more important, your hamstrings or your liver? And people say their liver. So now the next question is, what's more important, your liver or your attitude? Or let's say your liver or your emotional state. And people laugh often and say, well, you know, there's a relationship between the condition of my liver and my emotions. And so that may be the case in fact, but we're not just in anatomy and the physiology. We have all of these changing emotional states. They are influenced by our hormones, by our endocrine system. And I'm sure most all of you know that when your hormones change, it can impact your emotions. And that when your emotions change, it can influence your hormones. In fact, there's that whole field that evolved since it probably began in the early or late 1950s, evolved in the 70s, psychoneuroimmunology. Our emotions will impact our immune function. So there's a mind-body connection that we all are aware of. As if they're separate, they're not separate, of course. So how do we influence our emotions? So emotions have different component parts. One aspect of our emotional nature is pure energetics. In fact, emotions technically refers to physiological responses that are triggered by being alert to danger, like anxiety is a part of evolutionary biology. So there's a sympathetic, parasympathetic nature of emotion, but then the technical phrase is cognitively saturated. We have ideas in response to triggers. So an emotion is a mix of stories and ideas and these feelings and these physiological responses. So the ancients said that pranayama, of course, can influence emotions, but also chanting was a very important tool because chanting has meaning. And chanting, if you are chanting things that are connected to a symbolism that speaks to your heart, chanting can touch you at a place where your mind and your heart as in emotions, meet. So chanting, breathing, and then of course meditation, deeper science, can help us begin to gain mastery of our emotions, to begin to help us, just like we have dysfunctional movement patterns, we have dysfunctional emotional, what we call samskaras. Certain kinds of triggers that the certain people that are most intimate with you probably know your triggers better than anybody else. And I'm sure many of you have been triggered by our current world crisis. So there's some overt triggers that plug into our emotions, and that then our emotions create stress in our system. So one example would be the anxiety, or the other would be the fear and the low self-esteem or the lack of self-confidence. And even it can lead to depression, or on the other side, panic, or panic and depression. So it's very important to gain control over our emotions. And in the same way that we can gain conscious relationship with our anatomy and physiology, we can begin to gain mastery of our emotions and apply the tools of practice to move from, for lack of a better phrase, dysfunctional emotions, or let's even use the phrase troubling emotions, to actualizing our actually higher potential of our emotions. The spine can be aligned, this autonomic nervous system can be balanced, and we can experience joy and love and compassion for others. But if we're plugged into our own self-interest and our fear and anxiety or our depression, then we're not able to actualize those potentials. So we are called to use the tools of practice, including breathing and chanting and meditation, to gain control over our emotions. And we're not just emotions either. We all have a story. What I call them, or not that, excuse me, let me rephrase that. It's not that I've invented this phrase. We all have a narrative we're telling ourselves about ourselves and the world around us. You know, I used to joke with students, you know how you're not who your husband or wife thinks you are, right? You're not who your mother thinks you are. My joke is, yes, you're not. And you're not who you think you are either. You're not your narrative about yourself. We're all telling ourselves stories about ourselves. We start telling that story when we're children. If you're a parent, like I'm a parent, my son is having his birthday soon. He'll be 27 in just about 10 days. So, you know, I watched him. I love him. So, but just for example, I watched him when he was a little boy, you know, have his character. And then he was starting to hang out with certain friends, and he would sort of like be a different person or trying on a different character. And then as he got into his teen years, and he became solidified in a character. In his later teens, it was definitely, he knew, you know, and now he's older and he's already beginning to unpack that. You understand what I'm saying? We all have a narrative that we've constructed. It's a construct, we call it vikalpa, that we've constructed as we grew to help us navigate our inner world with our family and the external environment. So unfortunately, the narrative we're telling ourselves about ourselves and the narrative we're telling ourselves about others and the world around us is often not accurate. And so the ancients helped us evolve the science of meditation that isn't about just focus. I was talking to one student yesterday who, for her, meditation was just about start focus. And I said, yeah, focus is important. Being able to master what I call the field of attention. Most of us fluctuate between attention and distraction. Being able to master the field of attention through what the ancients called mind training, that's just the beginning. To be able to develop focus is just the beginning of meditation. My teacher asked me to really bring forward in our yoga community the teaching of Svadhyaya. Svadhyaya is a form of deep self-reflection so that we can, just like this in movement patterns, until you become conscious of your movement patterns, all of your movement reinforces those patterns. Until you become conscious of the narrative you're telling yourself and the world around you, then everything you perceive, you're looking for this confirmation bias, as you have probably heard that phrase. And so we keep reinforcing our narrative. We need to become self-conscious of our patterns, our samskaras. In one context, my teachers told me that really the deeper purpose of yoga is to surface your samskaras so that you can become free of them. So Svadhyaya is a process of deep self-investigation. Technically, for a Hindu in an Orthodox family, Svadhyaya just meant chanting the mantras that you received in what they called your gotra, that means your family lineage. I was trained in a lineage that was Vishishtadvaita, and I was there as a young man, so they began teaching me that same Svadhyaya. I chanted Taittiriya Upanishad, and that was a mirror for helping me understand myself. That was the traditional meaning of Svadhyaya, or a way in which Svadhyaya happened is by chanting the text that you received in your familial lineage, which taught you about who you are and what's your right relationship to yourself, to your family, to your community, to God. So what they adapted that to the modern world where most people aren't following that orthodoxy, Svadhyaya is ways of becoming reflectively self-conscious of who we truly are and being able to break our identification with an attachment to these changing circumstances in the world around us and to help us get rooted in our true nature as pure awareness. So, and then we're not just, so we have our anatomy, we have our physiology, we have our emotional nature, we have our cognitive stories, our narrative, and we're not all of, only that even, we have a heart. We have the capacity for love and joy. We have a capacity to connect to things that bring meaning and fulfillment in this life, in the face of the reality of change, impermanence, and ultimately death. In fact, by the way, as an aside, I was a religious studies student, but I had been a gymnast in high school. So I wasn't particularly coming to India for asana, but then I was able to do a lot of it because of my gymnastics background. But Deskotar told me really in that first year or two that I was studying with him that the real purpose of yoga is preparing for the moment of death. You know, so that is a relevant question, maybe less relevant for the average person in the first 20 or 30 years of their lives. Although there are some already at that age, I was 19 or 20 when he told me that. There are some already at that age are able to look deeper at that. But certainly in the last stage of life, the sunset stage of life, our job is to first handle everything that hasn't yet been handled in the world, in our family, in our relationships. That's called antikrama. And then realize our true nature, that's adhyatmika, and ultimately laya, prepare to merge back with source. So that is connected to the heart. That's connected to the spiritual dimension of practice. That's connected to the symbolism, for example, of the deities, the gods and goddesses that we are working with in our Devata Yoga series, if you're interested in that. I'm just in week 5 of an 8-week series, but it's all digital library and accessible. Devata Yoga is the yoga of merging with the symbolism of the deities in order to find deeper meaning and purpose, and really to do the inner work of transformation and actualizing our potential. So there's also that dimension. So for lack of a better word, let me just call that the spiritual dimension. So we have anatomy, we have physiology, we have our mind, our emotions, and our stories. Oh, and I skipped something, sorry, before I go to the spiritual dimension, which is our behavior, our activity in the world. Our activity in the world is it, I'm teaching this past week all about Mahalakshmi, who is Sri, who's the source of goodness and good fortune. You know, what the tradition says is that if our action in the world is aligned with our values and our goals, and our values and our goals are aligned with Dharma, then we create the context in which we can receive those blessings and receive good fortune in our lives. So we do also an analysis of behavior. And in fact, in yoga therapy, we work with people that have addictive behavior to help them change. But for all of us, being able to become not only self-conscious of the condition of our spine and its alignment or misalignment, our neuromuscular movement patterns, what's going on in our autonomic nervous system, and be able to influence sympathetic, parasympathetic regulation, balancing our emotions, emptying ourselves of our story about ourselves so we can actually see what's really going on, and then influencing our behavior so that our behavior leads us in the direction that we want to go. And then all of that guided by the longings of our heart to connect back to source. And especially as we approach end of life, there you have the integrated science of yoga. So then we're using a practice, an integrated practice that uses asana in relation to pranayama, in effect, asana to prepare the breath for pranayama, and then breathing in relation to chanting and meditation. So breath to prepare the voice for chanting and the mind for meditation, and meditation to prepare the heart for prayer. So that's an integrated practice that weaves them all together towards a goal. And that goal can vary, and therefore the practice will vary. So I've been talking for 42, well, actually minus 5, so 37 minutes, and it's 42, and I haven't looked at chat, so I don't know if there are questions. So let me take a moment and just say that we have to end in about 12 minutes, if I've understood correctly. And if we do end in 12 minutes, that gives us time to discuss some of this together. And so I'm going to wait until Sharon comes back, and or I can just keep talking, obviously.
Good timing, actually. We do have a question here, which is from Kachantika. How do you think ligamentous injury is caused in asana? Do you consider yin yoga a risk?
Now, I'm going to assume that that is not a political question, and give as best a diplomatic and honest answer as I can. So let's put yin yoga aside for just a moment and say that ligamentous condition in the human body is mostly congenital. That means some of us are born, I make a joke like there was a factory special, you know, the contortionists, they're born with longer ligaments or what we might call technically lax ligaments. It's not, if you're born with that, don't think you were necessarily so good in your past life. And if you were born with short ligaments, don't think you were bad necessarily in your past life, right? There was just a shortage in the factory and they didn't have enough material. So the ligamentous condition, I'm making a joke about that, obviously, the ligamentous condition is relatively congenital. You don't use asana to try to lengthen or stretch the ligaments. There's a misunderstanding in some traditions that think that we use long staying asanas to stretch our ligaments, but that's not correct. We don't want to do that. Long stay can stretch the fascia. Movement into and out of is actually more effective in transforming the condition of the muscle fibers. Stay is maybe more effective for fascia, but we don't want to overstretch the ligaments. So often in all kinds of sports, ligamentous sprain is very common, and ligamentous sprain takes a long time to heal. As far as method of yoga, you want to find a method that's rooted in a correct anatomical understanding that is, and that it has a sense of adapting the way postures are done for different people, for even for the same people, for different needs, without talking about any particular tradition. Just be clear that you don't want to use asana to stretch your ligaments. That's a misunderstanding. You want to strengthen the muscles. You want to be able to stretch the muscles. By strengthening and stretching the muscles, you'll increase circulation to the ligaments, which can support healing of damaged ligaments. But we don't want to stretch our ligaments in asana. So that's my initial response anyway.
Thank you so much. There's another question here. Are there some basic chants that you can recommend?
Yeah, it's a very almost impossible question to answer, but of course I'll try, because chanting is so personal. And I'll just give you an example. For many years, we took students on retreat, not only Americans, but a large percent, I'm an American, would come with us to Italy. And we used to go to Assisi, because I'm big fans of St. Francis of Assisi, and it's a beautiful place. So for 18 years, we took retreats to Assisi. And what I noticed is when we were doing the Sanskrit chants, everybody loved it. But when we did Italian chant, like Prayer of St. Francis, tears, people cried. So the chanting depends upon your heart or your lineage. Because if you have a guru that initiated you in a particular chant, that's a good one for you to do. Or if you're what speaks to your family or ancestry, if you're connected to it. In the yoga world, just so I want to give you some answer, the most neutral kind of chant that is got universal relevance, of course, is the mantra Om, which points to consciousness itself. And then Namaha, Namaste, Namaha, all that. That Namaha, it's sort of like a little bit of a false etymology, but it kind of is like not, it's not about me. It's not by me, it's not for me, it's through me. So when you chant Namaha, when you chant Om, you're invoking what's highest for you, whatever your religion is. When you chant Namaha, you're expressing gratitude for the gift of this life, appreciation and thanksgiving, but also expressing commitment to do your best to take care of your life and to take care of your family. So Om Namaha, we do that. We would say that is the most universal neutral for people who love yoga without going into all of the other things. You know, Om Namaha, Om Namo Namaha, Om Namo Namo Namaha. Nobody would object to that. Well, maybe somebody would, but that's about as neutral and useful as I could answer that question. Really, it's about having a relationship with a teacher who can help you connect with what's in your own heart. It doesn't come from the teacher. It comes from your own conditioning, your own heart, your own patterns, and your own love.
Wonderful. So we have a question from Louise. In our sunset years, how do we keep strong and flexible while still focusing on pranayama, mantra meditation, time for asana versus time for more esoteric practices?
It's a beautiful question. And so I'll give you an answer to that, a simple answer to it. We all have certain structural needs, whether we're 18 or 88. Of course, our capacity is very different. And some of the needs of an 88-year-old are very different than an 18-year-old. But if you can, you know, the interesting thing is people ask how many asanas are there, and the tradition says, well, is there a million, 800,000, wait, 100,000, 108,000, or 108, or 18, how many do you need? You don't need a lot. Most of us need to, like if you're an asana teacher, it's a little bit of an extended answer. If you're an asana teacher, let me look at the clock. Yeah, I have a few more minutes. If you're an asana teacher, everybody in your class will benefit from strengthening their low back. Every single person in your class. Everybody in your class will benefit from releasing tension in your neck and shoulders. So I think that as you get to be a senior, you want to maintain the elasticity of the rib cage so that you can have deep respiratory function. So you can use simple asana like Virabhadrasana standing with your arms like that, you know, regularly. Everybody needs to have their low back strengthened. You can do simple asana like Bhujangasana without pushing with your arms, just working the muscles. Then you can use a simple movements to release tension in the neck and shoulders. So you can put together in 10 to 15 minutes a simple asana practice that will keep you strong, maintain the elasticity of your rib cage, and keep the neck strong and yet the range of motion. A lot of seniors have automobile accidents because they rely on the rearview mirror. They can't turn their head. So for seniors, keeping your bones strong, that's also like, but just go for a walk. You know, walking, maybe you can do a standing Virabhadrasana and then Ardha Utkatasana can strengthen the bones, strengthen the muscles, but also work to maintain this elasticity. So within about 8 asanas, done in 15 minutes, that's all you'll need if you're consistent. And then you have more time to go into pranayama and meditation. And asana in the service of pranayama, pranayama in the service of meditation. Still, the asanas you choose can help you fulfill the fundamental needs to maintain stability, strength, range of motion, good respiratory function within 15 minutes of every day.
So I have a couple of more questions I'm hoping that we can get in here. One of them is the starting point that the body mind is coming from a place of dysfunction, i.e. where we need fixing.
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, we have both. We have a tremendous capacity for joy, for compassion, for love. We have a tremendous capacity to be selfish and self-oriented. We have functional movement patterns and we have dysfunctional movement patterns. So the starting point that when someone comes to see me, the starting point that I work with them on depends upon what they're looking for, what they're there. And then as we get to know each other, what they need. Sometimes it's about, so let me give you a metaphor. And I think this will be worth taking just a moment, really quick. When I was not younger, but I remember before I lived where I am now, we used to watch movies and there was that guy, Johnny Depp, Pirates of the Caribbean, right? You know, and he was looking for a treasure map. So the teaching is that within us, we all have buried treasure that we're not even aware of. And then the other reality is that, and this is more in the context of war, unfortunately, and around the world in Laos and in Croatia, they find unexploded ordnance that are landmines. And so kids playing in the field die because they stepped on unexploded ordnance. So the idea, the image of landmines is we all have landmines in us, potentially calls them kleshas, seeds of suffering. So within us, there's treasures that we don't know about, that we can uncover, but there's also landmines that are going to lead to suffering for us and others who know us. So it's not that it's one or the other. It depends where our interest is, but our deeper work is to deactivate the landmines within us and dig up and actualize the treasures. That's our innate God-given potential.
And then we have another question here. How do you approach or structure an integrated practice without being overwhelmed by too many directions?
Directions of movement? You mean in asana or? So I'll respond while she's responding to my question.
Okay.
So if it's directions of movement, one of the things is that it's good to move the body. Krishnamacharya says sarvanga sadhana. We want to move the body every which way, but we don't have to move the body in every direction every day. So we can create like a mandala of practices. So over 20 days, we cover every direction of movement and still the practices can be shorter. And then as far as other directions in life, we have to prioritize what's most important to us, but every practice can be a little different. We can be addressing short-term needs and interests or challenges, like I tweaked my neck or I didn't sleep well and I want to, or I have to do a presentation for the embodiment conference and I'm a little agitated about it. So I do a little breathing to calm my system down versus the long-term goals. So as long as we're alive to what's going on in us and we can adapt practices, then over a period of 20 days, we can cover everything we need. I hope that sort of responds.
It looks like it was regarding to intentions, those directions. So I feel
exactly.
Like
exactly. Well, then, so you can do if you have time, if your practice is reduced to under 30 minutes, and I'm doing on these live streaming classes, by the way, 30 to 40 minute practice, you can do an extraordinarily deep work in a short time. Then you can do it one practice in the morning and one practice in the afternoon, or you can do 2 or 3 days in a certain direction and then shift 2 or 3 days. There's lots of ways of doing this. Your practice should change based on changing needs over time. And then it's just a matter of prioritizing for the moment you're practicing what's most important for you.
Hey, I just want to get in one last question. There's so much enthusiasm here in the chat box.
So honored to have you. I feel honored to have received these teachings. So thank you for this opportunity, embodiment people.
There is, I can do one more question. It is here. Seniors, you mentioned Vibhadrasana and Uttasana. What are the other 6 poses that seniors could benefit from?
Oh my goodness. Well, you know, I apologize for not being able to be precise. I use the word Virabhadrasana, but not the classic Iyengar Virabhadrasana, but we do it, adapt the posture. I use the word Utkatasana, but really we wouldn't do that with seniors. We do Ardha, half squat, like sitting down in a chair. I mentioned Bhujangasana. Some prone back bend, not where you're pushing with your arms, but just using your back muscles are useful. And some turning of the head, like you can see me doing, that can be adapted in a simple forward bend, like child's pose, you know, turning the head, or in a lateral bend where you raise the arm and then turn the head opposite the shoulder. So we don't really pick an asana, but it's like the kinds of areas. So let me say what's important for a senior. It's important for everybody. Strengthening the low back. Gaining control over the pelvic lumbar relationship and strengthening the low back. Number one. I mean, not necessarily number one for any individual, but that's one. Releasing tension in the neck and shoulders, that's two. And that happens by working the head, neck, upper back, and the arms in ways where you're kind of relating to head movement and arm movement. So low back, neck and shoulders. Then number three, strengthening the legs is good for seniors. So walking can solve that though. Walking uphill can solve that. You don't need to do it in asana. But so if I just gave 3 things, strengthening the low back, releasing tension in the neck and shoulders, and maintaining elasticity in the front of the body, particularly in the elasticity of the thoracic cavity, so that you can have deep breathing rhythms. And maybe to support that, not only strengthen the low back, but strengthen the upper back, because a lot of people, when they get older, they tend to collapse. So strengthen the upper back, stretching in the front, strengthen the low back and neck and shoulders. Then after that, we would go to hips, because a lot of seniors end up with hip replacement surgery. So there's work can be done in the hips and it can go on and on. Of course, we train teachers and therapists so they can learn how to do that. And, you know, please look us up.
Okay, so we have in the last couple of minutes just a slight alteration of how we usually close because our sponsor video didn't play its sound at the beginning. I will start by making just a last couple of announcements, and then we will replay the video, and then we will end by Gary, you having the last word or the final word by giving us your top tip on how to stay embodied. So I will first start out with these announcements, which are that if you want to continue discussing everything that you've heard just now in the coffee break room, you can go to the portal, the Embodiment Conference portal. You can also go into the Facebook group to continue this discussion. And also, if you would like to be able to watch this again multiple times, you can purchase the library. Right now it is 50% for the duration of the conference. And not only will you be able to re-watch this recording again at your own pace, you will also have access to the thousands of other sessions as well. Purchasing allows us to make this conference accessible to everyone, including those who cannot afford it for free. And it also includes things like summaries, cheat sheets. There's audio only for people who like to listen in podcasts. So it's a great investment to make. And now we will play the sponsor video again. And then after that, we will take it back to Gary for your final word on your top tip on how to stay embodied.
Okay. That was Leslie Kamina.
It's not happening, is it?
So Kate, is it? It's not working.
No, it's doomed. Sorry.
Okay. All right. So hopefully we'll be forgiven for that. So I want to thank you, Gary, so much. We've had just this incredible enthusiasm here in the chat. I'm in reading some of these comments. I can see that there's people that have been following you for decades that have benefited from.
This means I'm getting old.
And so I will give it to you now to end this amazing presentation by giving us your top tip on how to stay embodied.
So thank you so much. And thank all of you for being here. I mentioned in the chat, I can't express how honored I am to have received this and to be able to share it. It's given my life joy and meaning. The top tip is really easy answer for me, because what weaves each of these dimensions together is the mystery and the miracle of our breath. The breath will influence our anatomy. You can just take an inhale and feel what it does to your thoracic cavity and through your thoracic, your rib cage, your spine. The breath is the major tool for consciously influencing the function of our autonomic nervous system. The breath is a major tool for helping us balance our emotions. The breath is a major tool for helping us disconnect from our narrative and come into stillness and present awareness. And of course, the breath, what Krishnamacharya said, the breath flows on, or actually not the breath, but prana flows on the breath. And prana is that one unique thing that comes from the causal plane. It comes from the consciousness and through the subtle plane and permeates the gross physical plane. So the breath, and this, think of our English word, the spirit, inspire, I'm inhaling, spiritus. It's the breath is a link to the dimension of the sacred. So understanding and beginning to work with your own breath will link your anatomy, your physiology, your mind, emotions, your narrative, and your spirit in one. So the breath is my answer. And thank you again for inviting me to be here. They put two links to our online courses and our website if you're interested in more. And I wish you guys all well in your journey, what I call down the river of life. You know where we're heading? We're heading to the ocean where we merge back with source. So enjoy every moment and all the best to you all.